Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? I'd be doing so good if you considered supporting In Defense of Plants. There are so many great ways of doing that, but one of the best is to pick up some of our customizable merch. All you have to do is click on apparel at the top of the screen over at indefenseofplants.com or navigate to the show notes. I have the links there as well. All of our merch is really cool vintage prints, and every style is customizable so you can find something that works for you. Because conversations like this can't happen unless you support the show. Speaking of the show, I have a really fun conversation for you today because it's about habitat. And I can't emphasize this enough. Whether you're worried about birds, mammals, amphibians, they don't exist without habitat. And habitat is plants. To understand what wildlife needs, you have to understand the plants that support all of the species we share this planet with. And joining us to talk about this is Dr. Chris Moorman. Dr. Moorman has a background in working with landowners, and he's continued doing that into his science to make science more useful for private landowners and land managers. I don't want to steal any of his thunder. He's got a lot of great insights, and the work he's doing with his colleagues is so important. So let's just jump right into it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Chris Moorman. I hope you enjoy. All right, Dr. Chris Moorman, welcome to the podcast. I am really excited to talk with you today, but first let's start off with an introduction. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Glad to be here today. So I am a professor of wildlife ecology at North Carolina State University, and my research teaching and outreach expertise focuses on a study and education related to the effects of human-induced land use on wildlife. And my goal is always to explore ways to integrate conservation strategies into these working landscapes so that the human well-being, the human health, and the economic drivers are minimally affected.
Right on. Yeah, I'm sure our species gives you lots of questions to ask and many, many lifetimes worth of questions at that. But where did this all begin? I mean, were you always interested in sort of working landscapes, wildlife ecology, or did you kind of stumble into it throughout life?
Yeah, as a kid, I was really an outdoor kid. I love the outdoors, and I had an inherent passion for nature, including animals. I actually didn't even realize it, maybe. I had a Boy Scout troop leader that once told me that I should study birds as a profession, and I laughed about that and thought, why would he say that? So he saw something in me that I didn't even see. And then I ended up going to college to study wildlife ecology. And I sort of knew from the very beginning I wanted to be a college professor. So I followed through with that. My interest in wildlife ecology evolved over time. I always had a passion for birds, but really my interests now are more rooted in the questions related to working landscapes and integrating conservation in working landscapes. And that includes urban landscapes, agriculture, managed forest. And I work on a wide range of species. That does include songbirds. That's what I did my dissertation research on, but I also study coyotes, white-tailed deer. I'm just finishing a big study on wild turkeys. I've studied salamanders and snakes and lizards and rats and mice and you name it, just about everything.
Wow. I mean, that's great. That's what's awesome about ecology is you really can kind of dip your toe into different waters, and it's all related on some level. And, you know, when you think about the landscape today, you don't have many places, at least, you know, where it's not a working landscape on some level. I mean, we have wilderness areas, but those are much fewer in number than areas where people are making a living on some level or recreating on some level, correct?
Yeah. So my work is largely in the eastern U.S., and there is really no such thing as a pristine landscape anymore in the eastern U.S. All the landscapes in the eastern U.S. have been heavily altered by humans over the past. Even some of our large protected areas are areas that have sort of come back after pretty significant human effects. And then, you know, I always stress to my students that really in the modern day ecological landscape has entirely been shaped by humans, because in the Western Hemisphere, we've had humans here for at least the past 15,000 years since the last ice age. So
right.
Humans have always played a role in our modern landscapes. of course, those human-induced influences change rapidly, and certainly they're more severe and sort of widespread than they've ever been now.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a really important point to bring across because, you know, in the interactions I have, especially with, you know, early education undergrads, people that maybe haven't spent a lot of time in ecology texts or literature, this idea of can't we just let it go, let hands off, no human involvement. And that to me is like, it's a fallacy, as you just said. I mean, for at least 15,000 years, people have been messing around here and some level, right? And so I'd like to think, like, when it comes to wildlife ecology, this idea of hands off is just, it's not realistic, correct?
No, and it's not realistic for those reasons you just mentioned. It's also really impossible because humans are influencing the planet at a sort of comprehensive global scale. So there's no such thing as hands off. I mean, even if you never, if humans weren't allowed to go into some place, there's still human influences happening there. Changes in air quality, changes potentially in water quality, and certainly changes in climate.
Yeah, yeah. And so with your science, the way you do research, you're not a taxonomist. You're not going out and looking to describe a species, that sort of thing. You're not looking at anatomy. What does your science look like, big picture? I mean, what kind of questions do you go out and ask, whether you're working with turkey or coyotes or songbirds?
Yeah, so my questions are mostly about landscape level change and at multiple scales, but primarily at a local scale, and how that change influences wildlife response. And the response can be numbers of individuals. It can be the places animals go. It can also be potentially survival and reproduction, which are really important things to learn about animals. Mm. And this is a perfect podcast for me because really what I'm studying is the plants. So I tell my students that if you want to be a wildlife ecologist that studies habitat, you really need to start off as a plant ecologist, because when we're studying animal responses to the environment, we're mostly studying plants first and then animals second. So I study plants and animals typically. Sometimes plants may not be part of the picture, but those may be not my favorite research projects. I really like when I'm looking at the relationship between plants and animals.
Nice. That's music to my ears. Yes. Welcome to the podcast for you. But, you know, I guess that's what you're getting at when you say landscape level change, right? I mean, how do you measure change on a landscape, you know, whether that's stable state, quote unquote, or, you know, whatever projected future we're going to have? How do you start to quantify that? Does it lie in how plants are changing?
Yeah, so that's a good point. And so change is not maybe the perfectly accurate word in a lot of cases. So ideally, we'd be looking at change. Mm-hmm. So one way to look at change is to create experimental designs that are manipulative. So we have the ability to create some change, a purposeful change in some areas and not in others. And then we can compare those areas. And that's a real powerful experimental design. And I do some of that. Some examples would be two different fire treatments. So in one place we burn very frequently and the other one we don't. Another one may be a specific sort of forest management treatment. So in one area we do a timber harvest, another one we don't. In an agricultural landscape, it may be in one area we leave non-crop fallow vegetation along the field borders as habitat for wildlife, and another one we don't. So then we can look at those treatments as, I guess, as informers of potential change. So if, you know, in the agricultural world, we've really intensified the way we manage agricultural fields. And so as part of that change, we've lost a lot of that non-crop vegetation. We have herbicides to control non-crop vegetation. So by doing those studies, I can sort of help us understand how that change over time has influenced wildlife.
Right, right. And I'm guessing, you know, part of that big picture working with working landscapes, you have many examples of we did, we didn't, we have, we haven't, you know, those comparative sort of things are probably quite numerous depending on the partners or stakeholders you're working with.
Yes. And the stakeholders are important. So another aspect of my work that I enjoy is when I collaborate with stakeholders, and it may be agency partners, it could be industry, or it may even be private landowners. So right now, the wild turkey research project we're finishing in North Carolina is fairly unique in that it was entirely conducted on private lands. Ooh. And these are non-industrial private lands. So these are just your average private landowner. And I believe we had around 250 individual landowners that collaborated.
Wow.
To allow us to study wild turkeys. And, you know, the eastern U.S. is mostly private. So it's important for us to study ecological responses on private lands because they can be different than on public lands. But most studies are on public lands because that's who funds them, and that's where access is easy, and you can have access to a huge land base with only one landowner versus trying to work with hundreds of landowners, which can be complicated at times. Sure.
Yeah, and you know, with that in mind, I guess from more the sociological side of what you do, what people in your lab end up doing is, how is the response? I mean, there is sort of this media-based idea that like people are really anti-academia or anti-conservation and science in general. And, you know, a lot of times it's more about the kind of ways you go about talking about it. So in your experience with all the landowners, stakeholders that you've worked with, has obviously there's challenges, obviously there's misunderstandings, but do you get a lot of really positive interactions out of this sort of work?
Almost entirely positive. Awesome. There are exceptions. So, sure. But I would say 95% positive. Certainly it depends on what you're asking of the partnering landowner. And, you know, if you're asking them to do things that have economic cost to them, they would be more resistant. Mm-hmm. But certainly if they're being asked to do things that are fair to them, they're very interested. They're very interested in the outcomes of the research. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they may even be willing to change their own practices based on what comes from the project.
That's very encouraging.
You know, these working landowners, in many cases, they depend on the land for sure. Their income or to put their kids through college or for their retirement. So we have to keep that in mind when we hold these folks at too high of a standard.
Right, right. But that's where I think research like yours is really interesting, because you get to tease apart what does and what doesn't work, or at least from the context of whatever you're studying at that time, what helps populations or keeps them stable. And with that in mind, I mean, the working landscape is exactly that. You can't just hands off it and expect people to be able to hold on to that land, let alone do anything with it. So when you're talking about going into setting up a research, say on a coyote or a turkey or a songbird, I mean, going back to this plant idea, is it sort of get the baseline, figure out what species, like how do you look at plants for this sort of work?
Yeah. So it depends on the scale. So at the smallest scale, the most local scale, we will go out and hand measure vegetation. And so usually that's a point-based scale. So there would be some point of interest. So the point of interest may be a wild turkey nest. It may be a songbird nest. It may be a songbird singing location. It might be a birth site for a white-tailed deer. I'm doing a project right now with white-tailed deer, and we're looking at birth site selection. So then we could go locally and measure the vegetation structure and composition. There are tools to measure that. We can measure canopy cover. We can measure the density of vegetation at different layers, including the ground cover. You can measure species composition, which sometimes matters and sometimes doesn't. My experience is structure really is typically the more important driver for wildlife response. Mm. Not always.
Sure.
As you get to larger scales, it's really impossible to measure everything, you know, at the small scale, at a large scale. So in that case, we have emerging technologies. We have remote sensing technologies where we satellites or other sources of imagery allow us to sort of project vegetation cover across large areas. Now, the challenge there is that as you get a more coarse resolution, you lose detail. Mm-hmm. There are new technologies called like LIDAR. LIDAR shoots lasers down, and based on where the plants are intercepted by the LIDAR beams, it can give you returns, and it gives you a picture of the structure of vegetation, which is really nice. And that kind of information can be available across a very large scale. I mean, that technology is emerging very rapidly.
Yeah,
that's not my area of expertise, but I certainly rely on partnerships with people that have that expertise when we're doing these sorts of studies. So we can look at multi-scales. And so I recently had a student that looked at wildlife response at multiple scales. So we measured the, say, songbird abundance or species richness based on very local measurements. And then we also measured it based on larger scale on remote sense data.
Right.
And both scales mattered. And for different reasons. And so, you know, I think most ecologists would tell you it's important for us to consider animal responses to the environment at multiple scales for that very reason.
Yeah. Just because I have a bird in my front yard does not mean, you know, regionally they're doing well. It could just be concentrated, right? And that's, I love those cross-scale comparisons. And, you know, thinking of the advancement of technology, the rate at which it's happening, and the cost going down in many instances for different technologies, I'm sure in the last decade and a half, work like yours has just really exploded. And finding partners is really important because you can't be an expert in all of these tech. But, you know, I'm sure it's really, really advanced fairly recently.
Incredible. And that's sort of what keeps a lot of people in business. It sort of keeps us in business. Sometimes it's a little weird because we're sort of revisiting the same questions that maybe Aldo Leopold visited in the 1930s. But we're using new technology to address similar sorts of questions or conservation issues. And we may learn new things. A lot of times we sort of reiterate the same things that he knew and observed. It's fun. These new technologies are fun. I guess for me, a lot of the new technology I use is related to GPS or global positioning system telemetry.
Mm.
So now, you know, when I was a student, that wasn't available. We had to go out with an antenna and you walked around and you got radio telemetry, which was very high frequency signals that came from the transmitter that you attached to the animal. And you only got information when you were able to go out and listen for that animal. And then even then you had to either triangulate, which has error, where you have to, the triangulates, you get, you measure from three directions and you, where those lines cross is where the animal is, or you could go straight to the animal, which is takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Now we just put these transmitters on animals and we let them go, and the transmitter's collecting GPS coordinates constantly and uploading them to a satellite or to a cell phone tower. And we just sit in our office and the data just piles in. And that works really well for animals that are large enough to carry those bigger transmitters.
Sure.
Songbirds really are, unfortunately, are still a bit small, although the technology's coming for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, who knows in another decade what will be possible with microchips and that sort of thing. But I want to go back to this idea of structure, because it's something that you hear a lot. You even hear it in sort of the horticultural realm, especially if you're getting into native plants. A structure matters. You got to have a lot of structure in the landscape. In your line of work, what is structure? How do you start thinking about structure scientifically?
Yeah, so the way I define structure to students is it's a measure or sort of an index of the number of layers of your vegetation profile that have vegetation in them. Mm. So when you have multiple layers that have vegetation, then you have more complex structure. So an example would be a vegetation profile that had plants in the understory, midstory, and canopy.
Okay.
So that would be a very complex plant community. A more simple structure would be a plant community that maybe only had vegetation in one layer, say just the canopy. So many of our eastern North American forests are fairly closed canopy, so there's not a lot of sunlight that gets through the canopy, so there's not much structure below the canopy. So in that case, the animals that depend on the vegetation below the canopy do not get the food and cover resources that they need, and those animals will be absent. We can also think of structure at a finer scale. So, you know, you might be saying, oh my gosh, well, a prairie only has vegetation in one layer, but we could look at a prairie at a finer scale resolution and look for structural heterogeneity within that single layer. So, you know, how much vegetation is really close to the ground or further above the ground, you know, inches or meters above the ground, is you can also look at composition within that very fine scale of how much of the vegetation is forb, how much is grass, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
Structure is, you know, composition does matter, but structure is super important. And especially to birds, I love birds. I love using birds as a teaching tool.
Yeah.
Sometimes students go, oh gosh, more bird stuff. But birds are so predictably connected to vegetation, and especially so predictably connected to vegetation structure.
Hmm.
I just love them because I can predict. I mean, I tell students, like, you could blindfold me, take me somewhere, let me out of the car, and I can hear the birds singing, and I can tell you, I can describe the vegetation condition simply by hearing the birds that are singing because they're so predictable.
Wow. I love that. Yeah, I heard an ornithologist once say, you know, someone said something about, like, well, I have a lot of this bird. And they said, well, remember, the presence of that bird means the absence of this, 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 and this. And I'm guessing that's sort of starting to get at what you're talking about, because if you have a grassland bird sound, you could tell there's probably not a lot of trees out there.
Right. Exactly. I tell the students they're always winners and losers. And if there's one thing I want them to remember at the end of the class or the end of the experience, is that they're always winners and losers. And that this myth that we can do everything everywhere all the time, it sort of bogs us down.
Right.
So every animal has a different set of food and cover requirements or habitat requirements. And so every place is going to provide some habitat for some species and not for others. So they're winners and losers. On a large scale, we can try to accommodate all animals, but right. At a small scale, we have to remember that only certain things can be there.
Yeah, that's a really great point to drive across. And I like sort of using birds as the vehicle for that, because you hear these sorts of arguments in the native plant gardening community all the time, is like, how do I maximize this? It's like, well, you have less than an acre. Maybe we start picking a handful of things and working with, get as many plants that fit that into the world and see what shows up. There's never going to be, we're going to get this deep woods, old growth species, plus this grassland species, plus, it's not realistic in small scales. But that's, again, coming back to that landscape perspective and again, working across multiple scales.
Yeah, I say identify your focal species. So that's another important message, because they're always winners and losers, identify your focal species. So you're giving good advice. But if somebody did say, how can I maximize bird species richness at any scale, you just want to diversify the vegetation.
Right.
But that may come at the expense of some animal that would not thrive in that condition.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's why niches exist.
Yeah.
Exactly. Can't occupy them both at the same time. But, thinking about the ways in which you have to study this, I understand why species composition might not be the easiest thing, or at least the most time effective thing in a lot of these studies, but you can start to see the relationship between composition and structure based on what you just had outlined. Because if the more similar, the more homogeneous the vegetation layer is, the less structure there is, because, a stand of pine, one species of pine is going to look very similar than a stand of even five different species of pine. And I could see where, structure can almost be sort of a correlate with diversity of plant species.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, composition certainly is related to structure. And composition is important because it defines the successional stage of a plant community. Mm. So, we often think of early succession as ecologists. Early succession is the plant community that comes up soon after a disturbance. And those early succession plant communities are going to be dominated by herbaceous plants, grasses and forbs. And so in that case, composition is of those herbaceous plants is going to define the structure there. And then as woody plants begin to dominate over time through the successional process, the woody plants are going to drive drastic changes in structure.
Mm.
And you're going to see animals respond to those changes, very predictably for most species. And then there's some species that are everywhere all the time. So,
right.
Like our state bird is a northern cardinal. They're pretty much everywhere. So
they don't seem to be too bothered.
No, they don't.
But again, winners and losers. And we just happen to create a lot of winning conditions for birds like that. But, when I think of humans, especially in Eastern North America, I start thinking of invasive plant species. And I know you've dabbled in that topic a bit. How does that start to play into everything you've been learning over the years and just wildlife ecology in general? Because, these species are getting around. So birds are using them on some level because they can deposit seeds in their droppings. But I can't imagine that it's all good just because they can eat the berries. How does that start to play into your research?
Yeah, so this is a contentious subject, as I'm sure you're as aware as I am.
Ooh, yeah.
One sort of approach I've taken recently is to think more about the positives of native plants and try to focus less on the negatives of the non-native plants. Certainly, you're right. The non-native plants are especially fruit-bearing, soft mass-bearing plants attract birds, and then the birds are sort of part of the problem because they're the dispersing agents for those plants.
Mm-hmm.
But I stress to people that native plants are important because our native animals co-evolve with our native plants. So it's just like intuitive that if we want to conserve native animals, we should conserve native plants. And there are, vertebrate animals, which I study mostly. I do study some invertebrates, but vertebrate animals are a little less specific about composition, as we've already said, but invertebrates can be very specific about composition, and they can have very tight relationships with individual species of plants. And the butterfly moth host plant relationship is a real good example of that. Probably many of your listeners are familiar with Doug Tallamy's work, where he's demonstrated the important relationships between those caterpillars and certain species of native plants. And then that feeds up to the vertebrate animals. So the birds that eat the caterpillars are going to be benefited by us having native plants to benefit those caterpillars. Another real important reason to advocate for native plants that maybe is less commonly considered is the relationship our native plants have with our sort of local, quote unquote, natural disturbances. Our native plants co-evolved with the disturbance regimes of the eastern U.S. or wherever, and so they sort of thrive and promote those same sorts of conditions. You know, granted, disturbance regimes are changing with climate change, but not, you know, maybe not at such a rate that we shouldn't still, that sure, the native plants still aren't the better choice. And then, you know, non-native plants can actually sort of disrupt those disturbance regimes. I especially think about fire. You can look at many non-native grasses, either out in the desert southwest, where you have non-native grasses getting into Sonoran Desert, or in the east, where you have non-native grasses moving into forest, and then they are very pyrophytic. They carry fire very well, and they can shift the entire fire regime of those communities. And then they can change composition and structure, maybe to the detriment of many of our native animals.
Right. I like that, though. I mean, again, thinking about the positives, because so much of the message today is be mad, be sad. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that, but the only way we're going to get out of it is aiming for the good. And there's one way you can control that is by bringing and promoting native plants on your landscape. But you mentioned fire, and that's another realm that you've spent a fair amount of time looking at. And, you know, I love prescribed burns. I've worked on a bunch of them. It's really interesting to see the before and after and see areas that have been burned for a long time. But I can understand why people would think that's like the antithesis of wildlife. You're burning a landscape. But there's, like you said, it's a native natural disturbance regime in a lot of habitats. And fire can be a really beneficial thing to wildlife on top of, you know, helping you manage for the plant diversity that you want out of sight.
Absolutely. I love fire. I think it's sort of... probably every person has a little bit of a pyromaniac somewhere deep down in them, even if they don't realize it. So, you know, humans, as we've already mentioned, humans have been in the Western Hemisphere for 15,000 plus years, and they use fire as a tool during most of that time. So humans recognize the sort of use of fire as a tool to manipulate the landscape to benefit them. But fire is also, it's a disturbance, you know. The famous fire ecologist Stephen Pine says the Earth is a fire planet. So fire has been all over the world for millennia. And so our plants, in many cases, are very dependent on fire. And many of our rarest plants and animals, at least in the southeastern U.S., are dependent on fire. And so you might think, well, how can that be? So many of the plants, as you know, that are dependent on fire are maybe not the greatest competitors without fire, especially our herbaceous plants. So what fire does is sort of clears away that competition. It removes a lot of the woody structure and allows those herbaceous plants, rare wildflowers, Venus flytraps, that sort of stuff, to thrive. And then the animals are often benefited from fire because fire, one thing fire does is it really maintains a lush herbaceous layer because it keeps woody plants from growing up and shading out. So, it's, you know, we call it Mrs. Sun. So Mrs. Sun is very important to plants. So wherever that sunlight is going is where plants are. So when fire keeps those woody plants from growing up into the midstory and shading out Mrs. Sun, then those herbaceous plants can thrive. And then the animals associated with that herbaceous layer can thrive in turn. And, you know, I could go on about
that. Sure. Yeah, and I think it's hard for people because, again, our way of looking at things is day-to-day, right? We're just trying to get through each day. And on a day-to-day basis, fire seems very scary, especially if it's a wildfire that, you know, because of poor management, went unchecked and destroyed a community, right? But if we can coax it back, it's more of that different scales, again, coming back to different scales. And we're just talking scales of time. And you have to have sort of a longer perspective to truly appreciate the impacts of disturbances like that.
Yeah, that's true for any disturbances, especially in the eastern U.S., is that I know disturbance can be scary. It can be ugly. And that's not only prescribed fire, that may be a timber harvest, but succession and plant response is incredibly rapid in the eastern U.S., especially in the southeastern U.S. where I live and work. And you know, after a prescribed fire in our Sandhills region, it's black for a couple of weeks, but it'll be green within days, if not weeks after the fire. And then you might go back a couple of months later and you're starting to scratch your head. You're like, I wonder if this was burned. You wouldn't even know. I mean, just after months, unless you were, you know, maybe if you were trained to recognize the differences. So things happen rapidly. And if you don't have fire, things also happen rapidly, right? Change happens rapidly. And that can be for the detriment of some animals. And then ultimately it can be the detriment for humans if too much fuel builds up. And then we get more severe fires than maybe are ideal.
Yeah.
And animals, you know, animals can, populations at least, you know, I think about populations. Individuals may be killed by severe fires, but populations usually do fine. But over time, you know, at bigger scales, we can start to see problems. And we may be seeing that out west in some cases where we have these sort of mega fires that are now sort of emerging because of climate change and also because of these fuel buildups.
Yeah, yeah. But that goes back to this idea of mismanagement, right? These wildfires are happening because we mismanaged those forests for so long. But thinking of sort of this population scale, and this is something that really kind of come to the forefront of my mind with things like iNaturalist is, as a wildlife ecologist, you have to be able to locate or hear these organisms or have some way of detecting them. And I'm wondering, in your experience, has working with private landowners, especially in the eastern United States, kind of put more nuance to population numbers? Because, you know, when you look at records from sort of historic public lands, okay, we got a patch here, we got a patch here, but it's obvious they've only surveyed the public lands. When you enter private landowners into the mix, you have more potential for detection. I mean, has that kind of changed the game for you and your work?
It's changed the game for me a little bit, but it's certainly changing the game for the profession at large, big time. And there are people that work more with those publicly collected data sets than I do. You know, they're termed public science or citizen science or community science, however you prefer. But yeah, this is a powerful tool. So as a birder, I work on the platform eBird. So anytime I go out and observe birds, I try to collect that information and sort of upload it onto the eBird platform. I do it for the personal gains I have in keeping track of what I've seen and where.
Sure.
But I recognize the value of that data set to science at large. And there are scientists now, especially at Cornell, that are doing powerful research on bird response to global change, temporal and spatial change, because of those large scale data sets. But even locally, having data collected by the public can be beneficial. So for our wild turkey study, one very difficult part of the life cycle of turkeys to understand is the survival of the chicks once they hatch out of the eggs. So we could study the adults with telemetry. We can study the nest by tracking the females to the nest and observing the nest. But once the chicks hatch out, they're called poults, and they're difficult to monitor. You can put transmitters on them, but they're, you know, it's a pretty invasive thing to do with a little chick.
Yeah.
So we have volunteer landowners and the public in North Carolina and actually across the Wild Turkey Range now that collect observations in the summer of the numbers of poults they see with hens. And then that data set, it's a hen poult ratio, or essentially the number of young to every adult female that's seen. That's become an incredibly important index for us to track reproduction in wild turkeys and to try to better understand why many wild turkey populations are declining right now.
Wow.
And in many cases, the decline has coincided with a decline in that index. So again, that's where the public can play an important role. And there's increasing numbers of platforms for the public to work in. I know there's a huge pollinator network where backyard gardeners can observe pollinators. There's backyard bird observations through Cornell. There's iNaturalist, which is an incredible tool for all kinds of animals and plants. So, yeah.
Yeah. And boy, the more people using them, the more people are keeping that data in check. I mean, my partner just got an email from someone on eBird that from like an observation a year ago saying, are you sure? She's like, not anymore.
When I get that, I'm like, uh-oh.
What have I done? But, you know,
that one.
It's getting better and better, right? And that's, again, that advancement of technology. The more people on it, the more people that know what they're looking at can kind of check and QAQC those data. But boy, have I been brought to test. Like, oh, I didn't notice that hair was going to the left instead of the right. My bad. So, but that's exciting too. And, you know, again, going back to this idea of working with landowners, it's so nice to know that like the science you're doing is good for population ecology. It's good for theory. It's good for science in general, but it's being fed back to the landowner, to whoever the stakeholder is, to make better decisions, more informed decisions at the very least. And to reiterate something you said, you're kind of oftentimes rechecking decades in the past, Aldo Leopold, other scientists, and going, does this still stand? And if it does, cool, we were onto something. If not, why did it come out different? You're helping kind of be less wrong about the way we interact with the landscape over time. And working with private landowners is such a great way to kind of get that back to the people that need it.
Yeah. And you started off with a very important point to me. I work at a land grant institution. I started off here at NC State University as an extension wildlife specialist. So my job was to largely work with the public in terms of translating science to the ground. And then I moved into a more traditional academic job that's teaching and research based. But I've continued to try to make sure that my research is translated into a form where it's useful. Mm. But in academia, the metrics are journal article publications, citation indices, grant dollars, and that sort of thing. And that doesn't always translate to information that goes out to the public, right? Unfortunately. And I try to work hard at that. And maybe sometimes I don't have the most impactful journal article, but I think working with a bunch of landowners is a true impact of what we do.
Yeah. I mean, a citation index is one thing, but helping even a few hundred acres, let alone thousands, is so much better. You know, not to, again, it's all important, right? We have to be doing it on different levels, but you know, I'm really excited to hear that like your background started in extension, because you almost get to learn how to talk to the people before you go and do the science that could be useful to them. So I've even noticed it in my own career is like, depending on who you're talking to, you kind of have to adjust and meet them where they're at instead of expecting them to jump five rungs on the ladder and come hang out with you in the ivory tower, so to speak. I'm using big words here, but like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Learn to talk to the people.
And you also learn what the issues are too. You're 100% right. That was the best thing that ever happened to me. A young green scientist coming out of grad school, 8 years to sort of figure out what's going on, how to communicate with people, what their challenges were. That was really useful for me. And I, you know, my biggest audience was when I was extension specialist were master gardeners and gardeners. they love new information. They're passionate about plants. And so that, that helped me build my passion for plants and gardening.
Yeah.
I'm an avid gardener. I love to garden with native plants. I love to see the animals that sort of respond to those plants. Like yesterday, I have a bunch of native azaleas in my front yard. And yesterday I was pointing out to my son, there's a tiger swallowtail.
Nice.
That was nectaring on one of those because it's spring here in Raleigh now. So it's pretty exciting.
That's excellent. Yeah. And just like, it's that whole adage, like if you build it, they will come. Like if you plant it, you'll start seeing cool things. You might have to get down on your hands and knees to see the cool thing, depending on the size of your plot. But like, it's so awesome to watch life utilize life, right? And that's all going back to the plants is, you know, it is people management, it is data management, it is tracking down wildlife, but none of that would exist without that vegetation set of layers.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
No, that's true. Yep. Build it, disturb it, burn it, whatever it takes, and they will come.
Yes. So with that in mind, if people want to learn more about your work and understand what you and people in your lab and your collaborators are doing, where do you recommend they go looking?
So I have a website. You can find my website just by just Googling Christopher Moorman at NCSU or Chris Moorman at NCSU. And you can look at my website. We have a group here at NC State University called the North Carolina Extension Forestry Group. And it is sort of forestry based, but they do more than that. So they have a lot of publications on wildlife conservation. So as an extension specialist, I produced a number of publications including four backyard sort of backyard wildlife management publications that are focused heavily on gardening with native plants. There's Excellent. One on birds, one on butterflies, one on just native plants, and one on reptiles and amphibians. And then there's publications on prescribed fire for wildlife, forest management for wildlife, and so on and so forth.
Excellent. Many layers of extra reading for everyone. But Dr. Moorman, thank you so much for the work that you do. But most importantly, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about it. We really appreciate it. And I think I speak for everyone listening. Keep it up. We need you.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, in the meantime, hang in there and enjoy spring. All right. Fabulous stuff. What an excellent conversation. I can't thank Dr. Moorman enough, as well as all of his colleagues, for putting in the effort to understand wildlife conservation through the lens of plants and making it useful for landowners and land managers. That is so, so important. All the science in the world doesn't mean anything unless the public can utilize it to make better decisions in their day-to-day lives. I highly recommend you head over to indefensiveplants.com and navigate to the show notes for this episode, where I will put all of the links so that you can read all of those publications he talked about today and then some. While you're over there, look at all the ways in which you can support In Defense of Plants, because conversations like this can't happen unless you support it. As I mentioned at the beginning, we have a lot of customizable merch for sale. We also have stickers, and I have a book that you can purchase. If you're really looking to kick in, consider becoming a patron today over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. That is the best way that you can help keep In Defense of Plants up and running each and every month. And you'll get a lot of great kickbacks in the process, including access to bonus episodes. Speaking of supporting through Patreon, I have a shout out to Mohsen Kazmi, who has been a longtime supporter of this podcast, but has signed up at the producer credit level. So he is doing the maximum possible to keep In Defense of Plants up and running. He's also a great photographer. Go check it out. Mohsen Kazmi Photography, if you're interested in learning more. But that is it for this week. I thank you all for listening. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and keep checking back in. But until next time, hang in there, stay healthy, and get outside if you can. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.